The following is For Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
National security at home and abroad, new complaints about administration's screening of the Boston bombers, and serious chemical weapons threat.
The blemish on Bush. As the previous president opens his library, lingering questions about excesses linked to the conservative Federalist Society.
What war meant for Iraq 10 years after the U.S. attacked new ethnic violence, and important lessons about what went wrong.
Autism rights when it can't speak. A new book by a woman thought to be dumb and mute, and the psychologist who helped her to communicate and succeed.
The constant singer, make that Constant. Yvonne Constant is French, after all, but no stranger to Broadway and cabaret.
Plus, notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only, now a project of the nonprofit New York Foundation for the Arts. For your ears only, for the week of April 28th and May Day, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog.
Something's not right here. I don't want to be judgmental, but I want to make sure that we're safe.
Yeah.
Between Benghazi and Boston, we're going backward in national security. This administration is letting its guard down, and it is beginning to show.
I'm disappointed. We need to give them a safe zone. We need to supply them with weapons going to the right people, and we need to be prepared to secure these caches of chemical weapons in the event that Bashar uses them or after he falls, that it doesn't fall into the wrong hands.
The Obama administration last week found itself in a two-front war over national security. South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham was foremost among critics of a seeming FBI and CIA failure to keep tabs on one of the suspected Boston Marathon bombers. Tamerlan Tsarnaev, killed in a shootout with police after being tipped 2 years ago by Russia to his possible Islamist self-radicalization. And Arizona's GOP Senator John McCain was only the most outspoken critic of President Obama's continued insistence on more confirmation of chemical weapons use in Syria before escalating aid to rebel forces there, whose most effective units, ironically, are also Islamic radicals.
Meanwhile, a surviving Boston bombing suspect, 19-year-old Zohar Tsarnaev, was read his Miranda rights in a Boston hospital, then moved to a detention facility, but not before reportedly disclosing the location of a ditched laptop and indicating that he and Tamerlan had talked about exploding their remaining arsenal of homemade bombs in New York's Times Square. To consider the challenges both of Boston and Syria and the complex military, security, intelligence, and constitutional issues involved, for your ears only, we're joined again by 28-year CIA veteran Paul R. Pillar, now a visiting professor at Georgetown University for security studies and a commentator at nationalinterest.org and consortiumnews.com. Welcome back to the program.
Good to be with you.
Intelligence services in Russia picked up increasing Islamist interest by Tamerlan on the internet, even before he traveled there. Did U.S. anti-terrorism systems fail by simply looking for evidence of past or present criminal activity when protection against prospective terror is the goal? Were they not asking or prevented from asking the right questions?
You know, if we're talking about a kind of predictive mind reading about how someone might in a subsequent year go radical enough to get into terrorism, that's nothing that not only no government agency can do, but no one can do.
Well, Tamerlan was placed on some watch lists, but should he have been monitored more closely and certainly questioned after his return from 6 months in the Caucasus, which was precisely the trip Russian intelligence had been worried about?
Well, the list that he was put on was the so-called TIDE database, which is the most basic and most inclusive of these lists. There are literally hundreds of thousands of names on it. It is simply something where when a name comes up with even the slightest possibility that there might be of interest in this person from a counter-terrorist point of view, the name goes on. You're certainly not going to want, I certainly don't want, you know, all those people being subject to some kind of monitoring or surveillance. And in the absence of additional reasons to be placed on one of the more restrictive lists, I don't think anything different should have been done.
Is there within the FBI and CIA a reluctance to cooperate with Russian intelligence, given the brutality on both sides of its conflict with violent Islamists?
I think the issue here, and an issue in general with the Russians, is what the Russian authorities would consider as a matter of concern to them is not to be equated with a terrorist concern for us. And for the Russians, any uppity, let alone at least slightly radical Chechen, they would define as a threat. That is not to be equated with what we would consider as a terrorist threat.
President Obama ultimately decided that surviving suspect Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, a naturalized U.S. citizen, would not be treated as an enemy combatant, as many conservatives demanded. But do you think a federal magistrate moved too quickly to read him his Miranda rights and offer government counsel after 16 hours of interrogation under the so-called public safety exception?
No, 16 hours is more than enough to get whatever information they were going to get with regard to the immediate threats, if any, to the public that come under the so-called public safety exception. And that's true even though in this case you had a detainee who had an injured throat and he was responding in writing rather than verbally.
Let's turn to Syria and the administration's belated agreement with Britain, France, and Israel that there is evidence suggesting at least limited use of chemical weapons. What kind of evidence would be conclusive, and is it realistic to count on getting it?
Well, it's probably not realistic to count on getting it. I suppose the only thing you might call conclusive evidence, if you're talking about regime use of it, would be some eyewitness accounts, multiple ones, that say, you know, Syrian government forces, you know, fired these projectiles over at these opposition personnel, and the latter immediately contracted the symptoms of being subject to poison gas. And until we get something like that, I think we and the public are still going to be pretty much in the dark about exactly what happened.
We understand that President Obama and the nation are reluctant to get more deeply involved in another Mideast war. But even if he were not, how realistic are the kind of responses critics like Senator McCain are calling for? A no-fly safe zone, weapons for the least unfriendly rebel forces, protection of chemical weapons from the most unfriendly rebels in the regime?
Yes, it would be possible to set up a no-fly zone. But, you know, unlike, say, the Iraqi Kurds or even the Iraqi Shia who were concentrated in the southern part of that country, here we have a rebellion, a civil war that is spread all through Syria. And so whatever zone you set up would possibly benefit some of the rebels and would be basically irrelevant to many of the other ones. When you're talking about providing aid to the good rebels and opponents while trying to keep it out of the hands of radicals that we might not like, well, that's a worthy goal, but in practice, I think it's rather infeasible given the still inchoate and rather disorganized nature of the Syrian opposition. But I think the most important set of issues is even if you could get around those practical problems, there's the larger one of just where does this all lead? You can set up no-fly zones, you can provide lethal or non-lethal aid. That doesn't necessarily, and in my belief, it probably wouldn't at all, hasten the end of this civil war and the bloodshed. It might just fuel the violence to an even greater extent in the short and medium term.
To what degree does a lack of response to Syrian chemical weapons weaken U.S. warnings about Iran's nuclear program, North Korea also?
We've made a mistake in drawing or implying red lines in the first place. That boxes us in when we subject ourselves to these kinds of debates afterwards. But number two, even if that mistake has been made, there is a general tendency to overstate the damage to U.S. credibility in the eyes of other regimes, including ones we consider adversaries, because we are seen as not living up to this or that commitment. The way other regimes look at us is to consider whatever our interest and motivations are for whatever is the issue directly at hand. So if it's, say, the North Koreans, they are going to look at what our interests are in East Asia and vis-a-vis North Korea itself, rather than drawing grand conclusions about something we did or did not know with regard to a particular category of weapons back in the Middle East.
Paul R. Piller is a 28-year CIA veteran, now visiting professor at Georgetown University for security studies. He posts commentary at nationalinterest.org and consortiumnews.com.
Quote from the news, people fighting against corruption should be absolutely pure themselves. Otherwise, it all looks like political self-advertising. That was Russian President Vladimir Putin during his record five-hour TV appearance in which he justified criminal charges for alleged infractions by various critics and watchdog groups.
Next, the Federalist Society and blemishes on the Bush legacy. For your ears only. We have more for your ears only. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. It's nice to know when we work together, we really can solve problems. That was Maine Republican Susan Collins on the Senate vote to permit the shift of FAA funds to end furloughs required by the budget sequester that caused major airline delays. The House quickly concurred, though some Democrats complained that the sequester cuts continued to distress the lives of poor, aged, and ailing Americans. Also in Washington last week, a number of Democratic leaders reported complaints from small business about costly new aspects of Obamacare, and a bipartisan group of lawmakers restarted efforts to revive a new gun control law. Now this.
The political winds blow left and right. Polls rise and fall. Supporters come and go. But in the end, leaders are defined by the convictions they hold. And my deepest conviction, the guiding principle of the administration, is that the United States of America must strive to expand the reach of freedom.
There was no shortage of inspiring rhetoric last week at dedication ceremonies for the George W. Bush Presidential Library, featuring all the country's living presidents, and not the least from Bush himself. Coming practically on the 10th anniversary of his painfully overstated Iraq mission accomplished speech, and as violence there rose again, mention of that war-torn nation was notably absent, as were other controversial aspects of Bush's war on terror, including enhanced interrogation practices recently judged to be torture and nonproductive by an independent nonpartisan panel.
That policy and a number of Bush's other guiding principles that history may well judge a blemish on his legacy, including claims of extraordinary presidential power and so-called American exceptionalism, all have links to the little-known Federalist Society. Begun by a handful of disgruntled conservative law students, it became an influential intellectual powerhouse by the time of Bush's presidency, with members and followers at law schools coast to coast and at the highest levels of government and the judiciary. Its growth, impact, and prospects are examined in a new book titled The Federalist Society, How Conservatives Took the Law Back from Liberals, by Michael Avery and Daniel McLaughlin from Vanderbilt University Press. And to talk more about it for your ears only, co-author McLaughlin is on the line now. Welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
When and where did the Federalist Society begin?
The Federalist Society was started at the universities of Yale and Chicago law schools in the early 80s, about 1982. And as the lead-in represents, it was started by about a handful of law students who were sort of disaffected by the prevailing liberal ideology of academia.
And how did it spread so far and recruit so many followers?
You know, they had a conference within their first year after these students came together. They were able to reach out because I guess they stood out from other students. The group, in its very earliest stages, was funded by, among other conservative philanthropists, the Olin Foundation, who basically believed in them from the very beginning. And from that point and therefore afterwards, the Olin Foundation has funded them with an enormous amount of unrestricted funds. The Olin Foundation helped them really build this institution. They were also helped at the beginning by Antonin Scalia, who was then a University of Chicago law professor, and he continues to this day to be a huge advocate for them.
You write that the Federalist Society's first real foothold was in the Reagan administration. What did that involve?
You know, Reagan came to power just as many of these founders were coming into the world having obtained their JDs. At the time, Edwin Meese, who had been an advisor to Reagan in California, also came in into the Department of Justice. He recruited these folks and really set them to work, working on a sort of a conservative, conservative agenda for the Reagan DOJ.
But the Society's agenda seemed most fully adopted by the Bush administration, notably with ideas like the unitary executive. What did that entail?
So the unitary executive, in many respects, is a fairly well-accepted theory. At its most basic level, it basically says that there will be one president and one president only, as opposed to a small selection of governing individuals. It comes from Article 2 of the Constitution, which invests the executive power in the president, and that combined with executive privilege and the commander-in-chief power are basically the fundamental tenets of this theory. The debate ranges as to the strength and the scope of this theory and what members of the Federalist Society have basically what they basically believe is that the unitary executive power is strong and broad. What is really different about the theory of the unitary executive as the Federalist Society has become a proponent of it is that basically the president is the ultimate arbiter of what is constitutional and what is not, particularly as it relates to the theatres of war making and foreign policy. But, you know, our view is that there's a fundamental incongruence there between pronouncements of the Supreme Court, most notably Marbury versus Madison, where the court basically said, we are the ultimate arbiter of what is constitutional. There's a disconnect there.
And how did the society's thinking lead to the enhanced interrogation recently found to constitute torture by that independent panel?
Well, the torture memos, which many of your listeners will be very familiar with, I'm sure, were written in large part by two Federalist Society members, John Yoo, who has subsequently gone back to the University of California, Berkeley Law School after his time in justice, and Jay Bybee, who after his time in justice was nominated to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. These torture memos, the legal theory that defended the Bush administration's tactics were grounded in the theory of the unitary executive. And what they essentially said was, if the president believes that these various tactics are constitutional, then it doesn't matter what international law says, it doesn't matter what the Geneva Conventions say, what the president says goes.
Talk about the society's concept of American exceptionalism and the role it played in the Iraq War itself.
You know, American exceptionalism, in the view of many members of the society, is fundamentally founded in the notion of sovereignty. And American exceptionalism can be manifest in many different ways. And John Bolton, who is a longtime member, talked quite openly after President Obama was elected the first time that he did not believe in American exceptionalism. And the view of some of these folks is that you either believe in an American exceptionalism and you believe that in our absolute sovereignty to do whatever it is we wish to do on the world stage, or you don't believe in American exceptionalism. You believe that we should become more of a team player. We should obey various treaties that we've signed on to. We should participate in the United Nations, and we should be a part and play a role in global governance.
How does Federalist Society thinking and influence affect current debates on how the Boston bombing suspect should be handled, for example?
You know, happened with folks that have been arrested and detained related to 9/11. Which system should these folks be tried under? Should they be tried as enemy combatants and therefore tried under military rules, or should they be tried within the civil legal system? And many proponents of trying enemy combatants under the military tribunals, are can be found in the Federalist Society.
Daniel McLaughlin is an attorney with Nixon Peabody LLP in Boston and co-author with Michael Avery of the Federalist Society, How Conservatives Took the Law Back from Liberals, from Vanderbilt University Press.
Quote from the news, the chance to present their best cases on why they should not be deported. That was attorney Michael Steinberg after a federal judge in California bought his argument for the first time ordering legal aid for mentally disabled immigrants who cannot represent themselves.
Next, more on the military failure in Iraq. For your ears only.
We have more for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog with this news quote. What McCoy has done is dangerous and reckless and put my family at a great deal of risk. That was James Everett Dutsky on the charge by Christy McCoy, attorney for Paul Kevin Curtis, that he had been framed for sending rice and poison letters to President Obama and a senator. Charges against Curtis were subsequently dropped, and investigators later arrested his longtime nemesis, Dutsky. Now this.
If government security forces enter towns, they will create sectarianism. We call upon the government to withdraw the army from the cities.
As Iraq marks 10 years since the U.S. invasion, it is descending to new levels of instability. On the same day as the Boston Marathon massacre, at least 79 people were killed and over 300 injured in a series of bombings and assaults across the country, including 26 car bombs and 16 IEDs. Last Monday, much of the Sunni Muslim minority held a day of civil disobedience to protest discrimination and violence by the U.S.-supported Shia-dominated government. Later in the week, Baghdad conceded the problem by announcing a commission to investigate the killing by soldiers of at least 20 civilian protesters at one location. But it also escalated the conflict, for the first time deploying armed helicopters against rebel forces.
Analysts feared further deterioration of security as Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki holds out against many Sunni demands and seeks survivable relations both with Washington and his aggressive Shia neighbors across the border in Iran. The roots of the problem are long-standing, but the current dynamic was fostered most dramatically by the now-ended U.S. military operation. What went wrong and why is the focus of a new book by a senior U.S. officer who was there. It is Breaking Iraq, The 10 Mistakes That Broke Iraq, from the History Publishing Company. And for your ears only, co-author Ted Spain, a retired Army colonel who led military police operations for the war's first year, is on the line now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, ma'am. I appreciate the opportunity.
Many people say we won the war but lost the peace. You talk about the problems you faced in trying to establish a working system of law and the police to support it, symbolized to a surprising degree by the hats supplied to Iraqi police post-invasion. Talk about that and the cultural blindness it represented.
Well, yes, ma'am. The ball caps is just an example of the cultural differences. One of the several mistakes that I personally made was not understanding beforehand what the cultural differences were. I tried to install a Western-style police in Iraq, and that was a huge mistake on my part. And had to just deal with things like east side of the Tigris, west side of the Tigris. Believe it or not, when Saddam ruled, they were not allowed to cross the Tigris. Police versus patrol, which is something we do not have here in the United States. And, of course, things that was totally unacceptable that we're familiar with was a large amount of corruption and brutality from the Iraqi police.
On a more basic level, you saw the mission handicapped by the lighter is better theory of war developed by Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. Talk about the inadequacies of men and equipment.
Yes, sir. He was in the process. I'd studied at the War College a year, a couple of years before that. He was in the process of transforming the military, just as you said, that lighter is better. And basically, we invaded Iraq on the cheap. We didn't have enough soldiers. You may recall General Shinseki said we needed about a half million military to not to win the war, but to, as you said, win the peace. And that was based on the Kosovo and the Bosnia model. But we went in with about 108. Went in about a third of the soldiers that we needed. And believe it or not, we thought we were going to be in there for a year and stand up a new government and leave. And you saw how that worked out. Much like President Clinton said, we went into Bosnia to stay a year, and we're still in Bosnia.
Another civilian you saw fostering failure was L. Paul Bremer, first head of the Coalition Provisional Authority. What do you see as his major mistakes?
Well, the two major failures now, Bremer says in his book it was Secretary Rumsfeld. Secretary Rumsfeld said in his book it was Ambassador Bremer. I don't know who made the decision, but he disbanded the Army. So they took their weapons home, went home, and came back to fight us later. But what really had a huge impact on me is he stripped out the highest level of the Ba'ath Party, and that's where my most senior Iraqi police generals were. And as the generals told me, that they didn't have a choice. They were forced to be members of the Ba'ath Party. And that absolutely killed me. And I lost all the senior folks that I was dealing with. And we started over from scratch.
On the military side, you say Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez was over his head as top commander from June 2003 to July 2004. What were his major failings?
Well, you just said it. He was over his head. He had been... He was a good example of the Peter Principle. He was promoted above his abilities. And I talk a lot in Breaking Iraq about a leadership. And you really have to have – leadership is the critical part to make up for failures. No military plan survives the first contact with the enemy. And it's just like a quarterback on a football team. Quarterback looks at the defense. He's got to call an audible at the line. And you got to have leaders in combat doing the same thing. And Sanchez couldn't do it.
In a previous segment on this week's show, we discussed the Bush administration orders for so-called enhanced interrogation that an independent, nonpartisan panel of experts this month concluded was torture and that did not produce significant useful intelligence. How did you see the detention and interrogation process then and now?
Well, I have a chapter in the book talking exactly about that, and I can only speak for what I was involved in. And once again, you set the standard. We were struggling with, I was told by my operational lawyer, I had an operational expert assigned to me. He was advising me that some of my detainees were not subject to the Geneva Hague Conventions. My position was, and I made it very clear across the brigade, that we would treat all detainees, regardless of their background, we treated them the way we wanted to be treated, and we wouldn't have an issue.
What's your reaction to the escalating violence in Iraq today?
Well, my personal opinion is, you know, all wars are political. So the president has different elements of power available for him. But when the president, regardless, it doesn't matter if they're Republican or Democrat, when they make a decision to use military power, they need to let the military take over. Decision was made to invade Iraq, and we have certainly cut and run in Iraq, in my humble opinion. You see what has happened in the 15 months we've been out of there. We're about to do the same thing in Afghanistan.
Retired Army Colonel Ted Spain and former FBI official Terry Turchi wrote Breaking Iraq from the History Publishing Company. Now head of security forces at an Energy Department nuclear site, he'll be at a Pentagon-sponsored workshop this week on post-conflict governance.
Quote from the news, it's like discussing the future of shipbuilding from the deck of the Titanic. That was Roberto Quercia, director of the Center for Community Capital at UNC Chapel Hill, on the argument by banks that they must charge a 20% down payment for new mortgages, despite evidence that this supposed protection against default is actually undermining a housing revival.
Next, when it can't speak, autism writes. For your ears only. We have more for your ears only. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. It was too risky not to work because of the pressure on them from U.S. and European retailers. That was Dara O'Rourke, a UC Berkeley expert on workplace monitoring, on the collapse of a garment factory building in Bangladesh that killed more than 300 people and revived questions about government regulation of fire and building safety standards. In Texas, meanwhile, investigators are focusing on insufficient oversight of a fertilizer plant whose stockpile of dangerous ammonium nitrate exploded in a fire, devastating the little town of West and raising questions about the government oversight permitting development of homes and schools ever closer to the plant. Now this.
This cake would have never been baked if it were not for autism. Which brings us back to the question of whether or not the world is better off with or without autism. I know that it is better with. I think autism is a valuable part of human evolution.
It may come as a surprise to some people, but not everyone who has autism wishes to be cured. It's not an opinion often heard among the calls to raise funds to study the condition and its causes, especially these past few weeks of Autism Awareness Month. But then again, did we ever think to ask?
In their new book, I Might Be You, An Exploration of Autism and Connection, autistic mute Barb Rentenbach and her psychologist Lois Preslowski give voice to the life within autism, offering insight and wisdom to families as well as hope and even a little humor to those on the autism spectrum themselves. The book is an extraordinary accomplishment, taking Barb 10 years to write as she picked out each individual letter through a unique therapeutic technique called facilitated communication. And for your ears only, we're joined on the phone by Barb's therapist and co-author, Lois Preslowski. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell us when and how you first met Barb and the kind of autism she presented at that time.
Well, it was a little over 11 years ago. She was 28. She's 40 now. She had just had to return home from a residential community for developmental disabilities because her primary caretaker had gotten fired for smoking pot. So she came home, and her parents were ill-prepared for that because, as Barb tells you, you ask what type, what kind of autism, Barb would say the severe kind, if I may be so bold.
And what were the social and intellectual expectations for Barb?
There was no consensus on that. As Barb will tell you, she was disguised as a poor thinker, and it's a great disguise. I would say that none of us, her parents, myself, and Barb included, would not expect socially and intellectually what she's able to do now.
Well, what led you to believe there was more potential there? And describe how you first began using this writing and teaching technique, facilitated communication with Barb.
Well, when I met with the family, that was the only way she communicated. She touched letters on a letterboard. And that, combined with her behaviors, which were a lot of puerile and infantile behaviors, that was it. Now, I was a new doc, and we were taught in grad school that facilitated communication is questionable. But I wasn't put off by that. I just realized that was going to be our starting point. So we started from what she knew. And how did we find out that her potential was much more? Well, the depth of her writing and the exquisite use of humor. Her perspectives were so fresh. And the tutors and myself, we didn't think of that. So, you know, she writes in like sound bites often. And she would say things like, autism is my prism, not my prison. And comments like that, and the humor was just so rich.
This book took 10 years to write, and it's such an incredible accomplishment. How did the idea for an actual published book between the two of you come about?
Well, she started with history, because we had to start motivating her from some way. And we know that, okay, build on the strengths. So we would all, me and the various other tutors, that would bring in books on history and philosophy, and she really likes biographical histories. And we knew this because when she typed with her, she had one teacher in high school that allowed her to type with her, and we got some facts out of that. And I read everything she had written early on, and we knew that. So we built on that. We'd bring in those things for her to choose each day. But when you're studying history with somebody, you discuss it. And that's how it began. She had to start thinking in words and typing so that her thoughts and discussions could go. So we built on that. Now, psychologists, we keep copious notes and records and session notes. So all those writings were kept. All the writings with all the tutors, all of the sessions, and I bind them in binder after binder and binder. So she had that data. And when she finally found, you know, when she finally had enough introspection and thinking in words and starting connecting with others, and she decided, hey, I want to do something in this life and I'll find my purpose. When she found her purpose, decided she wanted to be a writer and advocate, boom. That's when we were able to go back and start compiling all that data into a book. This is actually not her first book. She wrote a book that she's since pulled off the shelves because it was it's a learning experience like everything else. It came out in like a magazine kind of format. And she's like, if I'd have known it was going to be so thin, I would have used bigger words. So she pulled it off. And truly, as a novice myself and trying to help her with this, her agreement with the publisher, she literally got pennies on the dollar for every pennies for every sale. And that was not congruous with her goals. You know, she's not a greedy person, but it is her goal to be able to support herself through writing and to help others. Well, so, you know, her 24/7 care, even now, requires resources. That was her goal, and that she wasn't going to get there from that point.
So, well, this is an extraordinary story, but I wonder if you have a sense of just what proportion of those on the autism spectrum have this kind of potential, if only it could be unlocked.
What proportion? I don't know. I think the best we can do is to help them find their voice. And to be quite honest, Barb has been very good for business. So her successes have allowed me to go into private practice, and now there's 30 of us working with many, many more students. And we see from those students that there's lots of potential, but you have to meet the students where they are, the individuals with autism, whatever their age. I don't know the percentages, but I know that when we take time to listen and we empower them, they often rise and exceed those expectations.
Lois Preslosky is the co-author with autistic Barb Rentenbach of I Might Be You, An Exploration of Autism and Connection.
Here's a quote from the news. Advocating for lower drug prices is a necessity to save the lives of patients. That was a group of more than 100 influential cancer specialists in a letter attempting to persuade pharmaceutical companies to lower the price of cancer drugs.
Next, a constant songbird for your ears only. The last chorus for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog with this news quote. Freedom came from a totally spontaneous place. That was folk singer Richie Havens on the memorable anthem he created on the spot to open the 1969 Woodstock Counterculture and Music Festival. With a passion for ecological issues, Havens founded the North Wind Undersea Institute, a children's museum in the Bronx. He died last week at age 72. Also dead last week, hard-living Nashville country star George Jones at age 81. Now this.
Ce n'est rien qu'une chanson pour danser toi et moi. Les soirs de vacances, les soirs qu'on n'oublie pas. L'histoire est classique, la ville est aussi. Et c'est tellement mieux ainsi. One of those songs that you hear now and then. You don't know just where, you don't know just when. It's one of those songs that are over and then. It's one of those songs that start playing again.
Talk about tangled roots. If I understand correctly from our next guest, that was a tune from France whose first lyrics were written in English by American comic Jimmy Durante and only then in French for the Broadway production of La Plume de Matante in 1959. It was introduced by French actress, dancer, singer Yvonne Constant, who, like the song, is hard to forget, especially with years of appearances on stage, movie screens, and TV with Johnny Carson, Merv Griffin, and the like. For a welcome refresher, Constant debuts a new show called One of a Kind, beginning this week in Manhattan's Metropolitan Room at 7 p.m. on Tuesday, April 30th. And to preview it for your ears only, Yvonne Constant is on the line now. Bonjour and bienvenue.
Bonjour, my God, you speak well. You have no accent, I would say, when you say that, so it's very nice. I am very happy to have a conversation with you.
Let's start with La Plume de Matante. How well did you and others in the cast think a French show could do on Broadway before it actually opened?
Well, I must tell you something. We never thought of anything like that. We just came to do a show, and that's it. It was not in our mind. Is it going to work? Is it going to be a success or a flop? No. No. But I want to say something. We started in 1959, exactly on Armistice Day for Europe. It was the 11th of November, 1959. And that song was a show for the song was in the show, all over the show. It was a cute little tune. It had no lyrics during the show. It came around with different gags, and indeed, it is when Jimmy Durante heard it had some lyrics written to it that it became a big hit. But it was never sung in French or in English in the show.
Ah. Of all the shows you have done on American stages, what are some of your favorites?
I think that if I really think deeply, I liked The Gay Life. The Gay Life was a show with Barbara Cook. And it was based on Schnitzel Anatole, which was a famous novel, and I had a very funny part, and with funny partners. The star was the Italian movie star Walter Chiari, and I had a fantastic scene. I mean, it's a dream scene. All the girls were in love with that Anatole, and they knew that he loved yellow. So there was a big ball, and all the girls arrived in gowns, yellow gowns. And I arrived with a red gown. So it was really fantastic on Broadway, you know, to arrive and be the center of attention, both on stage and from the audience.
In films, you worked with some of the best in show business. Any special memories of Gene Kelly as director and comic Jackie Gleason?
Well, it was very, very nice and warm to work with Jackie Gleason. He gave me advice on song, at least one French song that I should sing.
You also worked with the great Maurice Chevalier in a movie called Monkeys Go Home. Wasn't it romantic, to paraphrase Larry Horn?
At that point, Maurice Chevalier was not young anymore. So, and he was playing a priest. And I think he was also concentrating on his character and lines. And I had a chair on the, I love that, I had a chair on the set, you know, one of those Kansas chairs where the name of the star is written. So that was next to him, and I was very happy. He was very, very nice, really, but quiet. At that point, he was a quiet man.
What is the theme of your new show at the Metropolitan Room?
Right now, this next show?
Yes.
Well, it is called one of a kind because the new, not owner, but I say the new manager, when he saw what I had accomplished in the past, told me, why don't you do a retrospective of what you've been doing? It's not quite what I'm doing, but the way I am perceived by people, I am one of a kind because probably I say things ad-lib. I ad-lib a lot. But underneath, I would like to say that the theme is la liberté, freedom.
Ah, very interesting. Right after our quote from Richie Havens about that song that he created at Woodstock. French-born actress, dancer, vocalist Yvonne Constant performs her new show, One of a Kind, at 7 p.m. April 30th, May 7th, May 20th, and 28th in Manhattan's Metropolitan Room, 34 West 22nd Street, and metropolitanroom.com.
It's one of the songs that you think you forgot, but one of the songs you can't, one of the songs you can't, one of the songs you cannot, yes!
And this has been For Your Ears Only. For Your Ears Only On Air is also online at iTunes, YouTube, FeedBurner.com, and the Stitcher.com app for mobile devices. But to continue, we really need your tax-deductible donation. Please pledge to davidearsonly at gmail.com.
This broadcast was engineered by Justin Ewan at the Hanger Studio, Playa Productions. With interns Sarah Skirmont and Sean Deary, I'm Catherine Herzog.
Our show is a nonprofit project of the New York Foundation for the Arts with support from the GateWave.org radio reading service for those with disabilities and award-winning ACAM Associates, exceptional management, impeccable reputation for New York co-ops, condos, and condops since 1983. Learn more at ACAM.com. I'm David Alperin.
Now we're back with another archive segment, a major story on our show a year ago. This week last year, we considered the Supreme Court argument over Arizona's strict anti-immigrant law. From our April 29th, 2012 broadcast, hosted by Catherine and David.
The principal provision of the Arizona law that was discussed today really just puts the federal officials in the position to know who they have in the country and then decide for themselves what to do as a matter of federal law.
It profiles people. If you have brown skin in my state, you're going to be asked to prove your citizenship.
Two views of Arizona's controversial Show Your Papers legal response to illegal immigration. First, former U.S. Solicitor General Paul Clement, straight from arguing for the state before the U.S. Supreme Court last week. Then Arizona's former Democratic Senator Dennis DeConcini, after testifying about the law before the Senate Judiciary Committee, although the issue of profiling was specifically not under consideration by the high court.
Ironically, the oral arguments took place just as official reports noted a significant fall-off in the human tide coming across the Mexican border and an increased reverse flow linked both to stepped-up enforcement and falling employment prospects. To discuss the issues, the court's response to oral arguments, and the implications of a decision either way, we have Jennifer Chang Newell, staff attorney at the Immigrants' Rights Project of the American Civil Liberties Union and author of the ACLU's amicus brief to the Supreme Court. Welcome to our program.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Catherine.
Why was racial profiling off the table for the purposes of last week's proceedings?
Well, the Arizona law does raise serious concerns that police officers are going to stop people based on the color of their skin, based on whether they look or sound foreign. But the legal question of racial profiling, which is essentially whether the law violates our Constitution's equal protection guarantee, was not raised in the federal government's litigation against the Arizona law and therefore was not in front of the court. The ACLU's lawsuit against SB 1070 does raise an equal protection claim, and that issue will be in front of the district court in our case. It's also important to know that there are other legal claims against the Arizona law that were not before the court, but that are also part of other litigation, such as the ACLU's lawsuit, including whether the law violates the Fourth Amendment.
What were the specific issues that judges were willing to consider last week?
Well, the court was being asked and is being asked to consider whether we should have a patchwork of 50 different immigration laws in 50 different states or whether we should have only one consistent immigration law for the whole country. Put another way, the court is really deciding whether Arizona overstepped its state power by trying to act in the immigration area, which has always been one of national importance and exclusive federal supremacy.
And what was the position of your ACLU amicus brief on those issues?
Our brief says that Arizona has exceeded its limited state powers in the immigration area. Under the federal immigration laws, states can only participate in immigration enforcement in certain limited circumstances, and those are spelled out in the immigration statutes. They can only participate where, you know, in the limited circumstances that the immigration laws say they can, and with the federal government in the driver's seat. The state's limited power doesn't include the power to unilaterally arrest and detain people based on immigration status, which is what Arizona is trying to do. States don't have any inherent power to act in the immigration area because, as the Supreme Court has long recognized, immigration is an area with a special need for uniformity and federal supremacy.
Many accounts of Wednesday's Arizona argument mentioned the awkward moment when Justice Sonia Sotomayor, an Obama appointee, told Obama Solicitor General Donald Verrilli that his argument was, quote, not selling very well. Why don't you try to come up with something else? Overall, how do you read the reports of the court's questions and reactions?
Well, Justice Sotomayor's comment was directed at a specific argument that the Solicitor General was making as opposed to his argument as a whole. In any event, the justices did seem very skeptical about the validity of the two provisions of SB 1070 that create state law penalties for failure to carry alien registration papers and for working without federal permission. In addition, several justices expressed serious civil liberties concerns that the Show Me Your Papers provision would cause people to be detained for longer than they otherwise would. It came through in court that there's really no easy way for a citizen who happens not to be carrying their ID with them to avoid being detained for an hour or more on the side of the road while an officer demands that they prove their right to live here. And although Paul Clement argued that it doesn't take more than 11 minutes to verify immigration status with the government, the federal government, the Solicitor General made clear that, in fact, the average wait time is 70 minutes for the federal government to confirm someone's immigration status. And what that means is that U.S. citizens, green card holders, asylum seekers, domestic violence survivors could all be detained for over an hour while their status is being ascertained. You know, at the end of the day, we're hopeful, given that the court expressed a lot of skepticism about the two criminal provisions, and Arizona was really trying to read its law more narrowly as a way to save it. But we think it can't be saved.
Another justice, Elena Kagan, has recused herself following work on this issue as Obama's previous Solicitor General. What happens if that leads to a 4-4 tie in the current case?
A 4-4 split would mean that Arizona would lose this case because the decision below, which held that these four provisions of SB 1070 were unconstitutional, would be affirmed. And in that event, there would be no controlling opinion issued by the Supreme Court.
If I understand you correctly, even if the court should decide in favor of the Arizona law on these jurisdictional grounds, there will be a second opportunity to argue against it on the grounds of racial profiling and other issues.
Well, definitely other parties can always bring an equal protection racial profiling claim against the Arizona law. And as I mentioned, the ACLU lawsuit includes that claim. I think the possibility you're referring to is that the court might say this is a facial challenge, the law hasn't gone into effect yet, so there might be problems that could arise if the law goes forward that could make the law legally invalid. Is that what you're referring to?
That was part of it, but mentioning these other suits that are also working their way up through the lower courts is something to keep in mind. There's also the question of whether the Arizona law criminalizes religious freedom and humanitarian activity, the kind of help to immigrants that many churches and American citizens of faith give to immigrants based on need and not on legal status. Talk about that.
Sure. The Arizona law makes it a separate state crime to transport or harbor undocumented immigrants, and religious and humanitarian groups have serious concerns that that provision could be used to prosecute Good Samaritans. The courts, there have been several other states, in addition to Arizona, that have passed this type of law prohibiting harboring and making it a state crime to harbor or transport. And in every single case, I believe the courts have struck down that provision as being preempted by federal law. That issue is not before the Supreme Court.
Of course, your concern is the law and not politics. But what does your work with legal immigrant and religious groups suggest would be the impact on the votes of their constituents if the administration wins this legal battle or loses?
I'm not a political commentator, and I always hate to speculate. If the court upholds the Arizona law in this case, it could have the effect of really galvanizing immigrant groups to support political candidates and political parties that have more of a pro-immigrant stance. And I imagine that would certainly mean that voters who are concerned about immigrants' rights issues might be more inclined to vote with their feet and move towards the Democrats.
Jennifer Chang Newell is a staff attorney at the Immigrants' Rights Project of the American Civil Liberties Union and author of the ACLU's amicus brief to the Supreme Court.
Arguing Arizona, from our April 29, 2012 broadcast. 2 months later, in June, the Supreme Court ruled against key provisions of the law, including those that made it a crime not to carry government registration papers, to seek or perform work without proper registration, and that empowered police to arrest illegal immigrants for probable cause without a court-ordered warrant. The High Court did not bar police from asking to see registration papers in the course of enforcing other laws. Last week in Arizona, on the third anniversary of the immigration law's passage, opponents again sought in vain to have state legislators repeal it. Even a similar Show Me Your Papers legislation was reversed in Colorado, where it had passed in 2006. In Washington, Republicans in the House and Senate continue to raise obstacles to bipartisan immigration reform. I'm Sean Deary. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now, folk singer Richie Havens, who died last week at 72, and the anthem he created on the spot to open the 1969 Woodstock Counterculture and Music Festival.
Freedom, 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 freedom. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. A long way from my home, yeah, yeah, love. Singing freedom, 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 freedom. Sometimes I feel like I'm almost gone. Sometimes I feel like I'm almost gone.